This is the Personal Finance Show.
Hi, I'm Bo Humphreys, and this is the Personal Finance Show. Shannon Lee Simmons wants everyone to have access to unbiased and affordable financial advice. In late 2010, frustrated that Bay Street was only interested in clients that have tons of money, she left her high-paying job to start the Barter Babes Project. Shannon would offer financial services in exchange for any good or service that she needed. Over 1 year, Shannon helped over 300 women and never once accepted cash for her services. Unable to go back to Bay Street after that, Shannon realized her only option was to start the best fee-only financial planning firm in Canada. She called it the New School of Finance, and she never looked back. When she's not helping people at the New School, you can find Shannon in just about every newspaper and all over Canadian television promoting her new book, Worry-Free Money. Shannon was nice enough to host me at the New School of Finance, where we talked about her personal finance journey. Oh, and Shannon was also the first guest to agree to sing on the podcast, so look for that fun segment near the end of the episode.
My earliest memory of me and money is I have a family cottage.
Okay.
So just north of Huntsville. I don't have it. My family has a cottage, and I'm very lucky to be able to go there. Yes,
it's a nice thing, yeah.
And there are, it's a freshwater lake, and there are, like, clams in the water. And in the springtime, it is sand when you go in. It's very shallow. But there are clams that have, like, made their way up. And so one of the things that we do is, as a family, when you're kind of, like, spring cleaning or whatever, is, like, take the clams and just, like, put them out into the deeper water, right? So that you don't step on them and hurt yourself.
Okay. And hurt them.
Or hurt them.
Okay.
Exactly. Yes. You don't want to hurt anybody. So we don't want to hurt them, and we don't want to hurt ourselves.
Yeah, okay.
And so with little kids tromping through the water, you can step on a clam, and it can cut you
open. It cuts your foot.
And you can kill the clam.
I remember that with zebra mussels in Lake Erie.
Right.
So way back when.
So these aren't zebra mussels. They're freshwater clams, but it's the same. It's like you don't want to step on them.
Yeah.
So what my parents would do is, with me and my sister, is if we moved them out to the deeper water, so like you're not taking them out of the lake or anything like that, we're just moving them to the deeper water where we wouldn't be walking on them, right?
Okay, yeah.
So you would make 5 cents per every single
from
your
parents
that you moved out. Yeah. So it was the first time that I ever connected chores with money. So you're working.
Okay, yeah.
And the more you work, the more money that you potentially can make.
Unlimited.
Well, I'm sure there was a limit, but I was like five. And so like, I think I probably made 20 cents and we called it a day.
Awesome.
But it was the idea behind, it wasn't that my parents were like making me work or anything. It was just a cool lesson. I was the youngest child, so it was probably more for my sister, but I got to participate because the youngest child often gets to participate.
Yes.
And it was just the first time it was like that introduction of like work and money, and they're tied and that you can earn it. And that you could also have a choice, right? You can also choose not to. And that's okay, too.
It's true, yeah. You could have just gone and played games or puzzles.
Yeah, exactly. And then they also would, when I got older, we did have an allowance and stuff like that, too. But you could also do, like, bonus chores. So your regular allowance was, like, it is what it is. You have to do your thing. But if it was the fall and you wanted to, you had to rake up the leaves, and then you could get like maybe $5 for every bag of leaves that you did. And that was like bonus cash,
nice
right?
Nice incentives.
So I think that is like my earliest memory of even wanting to collect the nickels.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had a piggy bank and I got to put them in, and that felt really satisfying.
And that was your bank? Like,
oh yeah, I had a piggy bank when I was a kid.
And just, like, would it just sit there for a while? Would you ever open it up?
I did. I used to love to shake it. And then I started collecting international coins when I was a little bit older.
Okay, yeah.
But when I was like really young, I used to like to just shake it. And then I would it was actually one of those piggy banks with like the, you know, the little black like plug in the bottom.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
Really old school, like 80s style piggy bank.
Absolutely.
And then I would like, often I would take it out and then just like dump all the money onto my bed or something like that.
Okay.
And then just like play with it, which was probably pretty dirty. But like, I not because I was obsessed with it, but just like physical cash, which I think kids don't really play with that much these days.
That's true.
It's pretty interesting because it's like you can touch it, you can count it, you can practice math, you can look at it. Like there's a whole bunch of cool things that come with actually tangibly being able to hold money and learn about it that way.
And plastic is kind of
It's abstract.
Taken that away.
Well, it's abstract.
And you could probably put it in the dishwasher or something. I don't know. Because my wife is like cringing right now listening to this. It's like, oh, don't touch it. Anytime, like sometimes I would get paid like at a gig in cash.
Yes.
And I would just sort of like come home and make it rain.
Yes.
And it was funny for a second. And then she's like, get that dirty cash away from me. Because it is considerably filthy.
It's gross.
I never even thought about it. Like,
no, I never thought about it when I was a kid. That's for sure.
No, not. Yeah. And of course, you know, like I remember, there's a story about me eating dirt when I was a kid. You know, people
totally.
When they're kids, they do things, and that's how you build up tolerance to like bacteria. And stuff,
yes,
right?
Absolutely. And I so didn't even think about that when I was a kid either. And like probably, yeah.
That's why you have a great immune system.
Probably stronger today because of the money. Because plastic is
money,
making...
Yeah. You should have mentioned that in the book. The plastic, yeah, plastic is making everyone sick.
Yeah.
in one way or another, right? So the piggy bank, and so do you remember, and you get an allowance when you were a little bit older?
Yes.
Do you remember, what would you do with that? Like, was it the $5 for the extra bag and all that other kind of stuff?
Yeah, I don't remember specifically what I would do every single week or whatever, but I definitely know that my parents would say that I was like, I was responsible with it even from a young age. Like I was
really?
I liked to see it build up.
Mm.
And when you're that age too, the money for the sake of money is not a thing. There was something about achieving it that made me proud, right?
Okay.
And so I think that, well, I'm a Capricorn. So like, of course I was like, oh, is this the thing I'm supposed to do? Great. I'll just make a plan and do it.
Perfect.
And so that was something cool. But then what I also know that my mom has now reflected on in like later and told me, so I don't remember this. If I really wanted something, I was really good at saving it up. And then I would like to buy it. Right. So it wasn't like I would save it forever for no reason. There was always a goal associated with it, but I was really good at that. Whereas like my sister would just like spend it or save, like there was no plan, but I was always very good at like, oh, that's a thing. Oh, I need to do that. I will do it. And then I would meticulously save it up every week, which was pretty responsible for like a 7-year-old or an 8-year-old.
Yeah. I've been thinking about this lately because everybody's got a different story. Either they were just crazy spending or saving up for, you know, saving up for some specific thing. And I wonder, you know, I think it's just a personality thing.
Completely.
Right. It's connected to your personality. Like you connected money to achievement or the earning of the money.
Yeah.
And then saving up for whatever
the goal,
whatever a goal is.
Yeah.
And so that would just like your achievements and goals was a thing to you, and for your sister, not necessarily.
Right. She wasn't
so
motivated
much.
By it. Yeah.
So it's not like your parents, did anything right or wrong in that respect, or maybe could have changed that. They could have tried to change if it was bad behavior. Maybe they could have instilled something different, but for you, it seems like it is innate. It's in people.
Yeah.
But also you must have had some kind of example. I mean, the early example of picking up the clams.
Yeah. To keep them safe.
To keep them. Yeah, true. Not for dinner.
To keep them safe, yeah.
Which maybe is later in life. So you had the goal setting, and then, you know, what about when you like had, you know, first part-time jobs?
Yeah. Oh, first
part-time
job.
Fast food?
You know, yes and no. So
everyone I ever talked to in the entire world has worked fast food except for me.
Okay, so I've never worked in fast food.
Okay, well, there's...
So now you've met another person. There you go.
That's one.
I worked at Laura Secord.
Oh, Secord, nice.
So box and chocolates, eating ice cream.
Yeah.
So that was my part of my high school gig.
It's amazing.
It was great. It was great. And like I had this boyfriend at the time who would come and I would give him free ice cream. Oh, I just like outed myself to Laura Secord. But
whoa,
yeah, it was great.
Are they still in business?
I don't know. Maybe not because of me.
That's right. How dare you?
But
she was a national hero.
It was. Yeah.
Well, right.
Oh, no, sorry. Yeah.
The historical figure.
Yeah. But yeah, Laura Secord was a really good job. They were a great place for like a after work job.
Sure.
And then the other kind of job I did was I worked in a concession stand at an arena/rec center. So, you know, like with the fryer and like getting hot chocolate. And
so like
getting
small time hockey, like minor hockey?
Was,
or?
It was actually a rec center where there was like a pool. It wasn't a Y. It was in Burlington. It's called Tansley Woods.
Okay.
But like there was like, you know, kids' birthday parties, or there was like the pool, or there was like this kind of thing. Like the Y. Imagine the Y.
Okay.
And so then I worked in a concession stand there.
So that's kind of like fast food. You just said fries.
But like never in a chain fast food restaurant.
No. But it's the what it is about the fast food. It's the customer experience.
Oh, that
everyone they you learn buckets early in life about, you know, and then you build the respect for for people working in that situation. So you got that.
Yeah, and I would have got that at Laura Secret too, right? Yeah,
exactly. So Secret many people too. for sure.
So definitely the retail customer service experience for sure. And I think that's so true. I think you learn so much about how you deal with like people who might be rude to you and making people happy when they're frustrated and like kind of navigating that space at a really young age. And you know when you aren't nailing it and you know when you're nailing it, right? Yeah. And how to like, and how to move and survive within that place. And there's a boss.
I never had that. You know, I worked in my dad's dental office cleaning, which is a different kind of job, but it's very solitary.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was a mess in my 20s, but I, you know, gambling addiction and all that. But I was also a huge jerk to people in retail because I didn't have really any perspective at that point, and all I cared about was, how do you not know the name of the donut that I'm pointing at, right? Or how can somebody at McDonald's not, you know, want to help me more than they are? And it was just like, when I think back, I was just such an ass.
Honestly, right? I used to serve too. I served all the way through university.
Oh, that too, yeah.
And I, to this day, am an over-tipper.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, pretty much everybody in service.
Oh my gosh. I will, even if it was terrible service, I will still over tip because I know you might have just been having a bad day.
Bad day, and you're making nothing.
Right.
Otherwise.
And everybody's allowed to have a bad day except a server, right? And so that's why I'm like, no, this is fine. I'm okay with
this. Yeah. Yeah. Why is that, right? Why does everyone have to just put a smile on, even, you know, having a bad day? You know, it's a. There's a great podcast about McDonald's coming into Russia for the first time and how they had to teach Russian people how to smile and not be not have mistrust. Because if somebody smiles at you, they're looking for something from you.
Yes, they want it back.
It's actually it's like not genuine. In Russia at the time. I don't want to speak about today, but Russia when McDonald's came in, I forget if it was 90s maybe.
Yeah.
And it was such a fascinating thing, the training that to like, the like we actually have to say like have a nice day and mean it.
Yeah.
You know, it's such a different sort of culture. But yeah, so you did these jobs, and what about that money? You're saving for school. Are you, did you have to save for school?
Yes, I did. I had $30,000 worth of student debt when I graduated. Whoa. And I worked the entire time that I was in school.
Wow. Yeah. Where'd you go to school?
I went to Queens.
You went to Queens? Queens Commerce?
No, I went to Queens. I did economics there.
Okay, yeah. So very similar in terms of the money or numbers.
Yeah, part of it. But originally I wasn't. The reason I didn't go into commerce is because I actually was originally going to be a doctor.
Okay.
So I wanted to do the life sciences kind of route.
Sure.
And then I really wasn't loving it. And I thought everyone was like, oh, you're really good at math and science. You should be a doctor. And I was like, oh, okay, I guess I should be a doctor. And I really like people. And so that seemed like a natural thing to do. And
sure.
Then after my first year, I was really questioning whether or not I wanted to like move forward. And I had job shadowed with a guy who was a GP. And I was like, I'm just not sure. And he's like, take 1 year, take a bunch of stuff. And if you still want to come back, like, then, you know, do it. But just like, you don't have to make this decision like tomorrow, which was such a great piece of advice, right? My parents really stood by it too. They were like, if you're just doing this because everyone is telling you that you should, why don't you just take some time?
But we don't know any better at that age. How do we know, right? Like, you know, my wife's in med school now.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's already a pharmacist. She's been through all of this.
Yes.
And, but some of these, her classmates, they're so young.
I know.
And how do you know? Like, hopefully they know, and it's not just because it's a family obligation or something. Yeah, but at that age, I knew nothing.
No, I was 18 because I had a late birthday. I had no idea.
Yeah.
And so...
So, at least you kind of figured it out and didn't go the whole way through. And...
Yeah, I wasn't as pumped as all the... Like, I was doing okay in my courses. I was doing well in my courses and stuff, but... The other people who were really, you know, hell-bent for leather on being a doctor were so much more passionate than I was about it. And I was like, I'm a very passionate person and I know that about myself. So I was smart enough to know, you don't feel the same way about this. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you're not so jazzed about it.
Yeah.
What is that? And so then when I took a year off, not off school, but I just took a year off the science and math and tried a bunch of stuff. And I tried economics and I really actually really loved it. And cool. So I kind of like chased that, just kept chasing that feeling.
Was it like supply and demand and scarcity the basics or like, was it?
Yeah, I'd never taken an economics course in high school or anything like that because I was all chemistry, algebra, all the things.
Sure, of course, you're getting ready for science.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I had never taken a business course. I had never taken an economics course or anything. And my parents run a family business. So I had always had, you know, the context of economics in my household, like talking about the exchange rate was an important thing because my parents export.
Okay.
And talking about like demand and stuff. So I understood those things, but I never actually learned the theory behind them. So I think it was really cool when I finally learned about it. And because of my family business background and like just conversations at the dinner table, it meant something. Like I could take my parents' business and apply it in a way that I don't know if a lot of people get the opportunity to do that.
Oh, nice.
And I was like, and especially with the microeconomics.
Real life example.
I was like, oh, this is like when dad does this. Oh, this is like when mom was talking about this. And so it really resonated with me for some reason. And then I just really enjoyed it. And then I found the finance part of it fascinating. And I met a woman who ended up becoming my mentor later. And she worked in investment management. And for the first time, I realized that I could marry my love of working with people with math in a way that wasn't necessarily being a doctor.
Which was that part of the GP draw to you, that you would be working with people? Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe that was the major thing.
That's
right?
It. That was the bigger thing.
Yeah, bigger thing.
And I'm good at math.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's why.
And that is kind of what we do, isn't it? It's marrying the boring numbers part with the
relationship management
part. And you're a life coach as well, right?
Yes, also that.
Yeah. So that's definitely was that something that you took like in addition, because after you did the management, the investment management designations and stuff?
Yes, I did it during my third year out. Yeah, I did it because I felt like most of the work that I'm actually doing is around that.
It really is.
And not necessarily about the spreadsheets.
Yeah.
And so I make this joke all the time. Like it's like 80% life coaching and 20% spreadsheet.
Yeah.
And so regardless of what level of wealth. And so I felt like that would really help me hone those skills and also, I don't know, like legitimize that's what's going on when I'm in these sessions, right? And so, because I guess I felt like I was doing it, but that I was doing it without any sort, like just from like instinct whatever.
No actual guide or process to follow. So it
really nailed it for me there.
So when, and you talk about a lot of these stories in your book, right?
Yeah,
when somebody's coming in, it's like, why are you spending money on this thing that you hate?
Yeah.
Right? It's something like that.
I know.
But $30,000 of debt, that's a lot for, I think you're about 5 years younger than me, actually.
Yes. I don't
Early
know.
Early
30s? I'm 33.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll be 38 in September.
There
so.
You go. Good guess.
Yeah. I think we talked about this.
Okay. I was like, that's a really good
guess. Well, because I knew you're a millennial by definition. By one definition, or maybe two, I'm still a millennial being 1980.
Yeah.
A lot of people put it to 82. Not necessarily, but I do like, I know what it's like to be on the cusp, right? Like I love technology. I hate writing on paper or wasting things. And I don't use my phone to talk to people.
Yeah.
Right.
I find that the people who were maybe like born 1980 to 85 or like somewhere in there, the difference is like you had an analog childhood, but a digital adulthood.
Absolutely.
And so I had no cell phone in high school. There was ICQ.
Yeah.
But there wasn't like the same kind, there wasn't texting, none of that stuff. And Facebook didn't come until my very last year of university.
Okay. Yeah.
So I went through all of university without social media as well. And so I think that is like a defining thing about the cuspy millennials, right? Because the ones that are like 5 years younger than I, well, they had social media all through university or post-secondary or even into high school.
Yeah. And we got internet in my first year.
Right.
High speed, right?
Yeah. And I remember the day that the first time I ever hit a chat room and being like, whoa. Old enough to remember that moment. You know?
Exactly. Okay, so I don't remember having, I had gambling debt. That's a different story. But I don't remember having that much school debt. Did school prices go up way higher, or is Queens just really expensive?
Queens
or
is
living?
Living. I lived away. And I think that's a big part of the problem.
That's the key,
so tuition was like I didn't have RESPs or anything. So the whole thing was about $10,000 a year just for tuition.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And then I also paid rent and all that, which I worked for. So it just was 30 grand. I also did one trip at the end of my undergrad, which bumped it up to 30 at that point, because I was like, I have been living a broke student for years and I'm going to go on this trip. And that ended up on my student line of credit.
So you're sitting with an economics degree, Queens.
Yes.
From Queens. And you've met your mentor already?
Yeah, well, yeah.
So and you're working, you're already working, getting, because you have your CIM?
Yeah.
Your Chartered Investment Manager?
Yep. So this makes me sound like such a dork. I'm going to be honest with you.
This is a podcast for dorks, by the way.
Okay, well, then I'm in the right place. So I promise I did have friends. But like, I was always just very like driven and passionate. And so when I kind of figured out, like when it clicked around, like kind of where I want to be or what I want to do. So her name is Helen, my mentor. She had said casually, like, I'm sure she had no idea that everything she said I took so seriously. And so she had said, if you want to break into, you know, the investment management world, once you graduate, blah, blah, here are some designations that you might want to think about doing at that time.
Okay.
So of course I spent my summer in between third year and fourth year, just like starting to do that.
Yeah. Okay.
I am very much like Rory Gilmore a little bit that way.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually get your reference.
There you go. Oh, thank you. And so I started boning up on my like securities course and all that kind of thing while I was still in school.
Wow. Well done.
So that I had things on my resume when I graduated, I already had it there.
Smart.
So it was smart, absolutely. And in retrospect, like, what a smart idea. But I have to tell you, like, my mom's an artist and my dad is an entrepreneur, and both of them were like, what? Like, this is completely internally driven.
Yeah.
It was absolutely not put on me at all by anybody.
Well, that's good.
And like, my mom always makes the joke too, that like, I was the kid that like, when we were running a lemonade stand, I was like, let's scale this thing. Right. Like, I guess I'm very much like the pursuit. I love the building. I love the building towards something.
Gross.
The goal and the path to it is very exciting for me in a really satisfying way. And so I think that, and not chasing money, just like whatever that goal is, I want to like do what I can to make that happen. And so that's what I was doing while I was in school, so that I was able to secure a job on the other side, because I knew I was going to have all this student debt that I had to pay off. Right.
That's right.
And I was very afraid of the student debt. Like, I knew the reality of what that was going to cost me. And I needed a job.
Yeah. Even if, you know, you didn't, maybe you were just paying interest if it was a bank loan
in school.
As soon as it, what, a year out or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had a similar one. So you did. You must have got that awesome job.
I did.
Well, awesome job for the time.
For the time. Yeah. I got an entry-level position at a boutique investment management firm called PHNN.
Okay.
And it was fantastic. It was wonderful. It was like this little oasis in the financial industry of like wonderful people and all that stuff. And I lived at home for 1 year.
Oh, that's smart.
And I was very lucky to be able to do that, right? And then I commuted in on the go.
Yeah.
And so I did the whole thing, but I was so used to living like a broke student that I just continued to live like a broke student, but I was at home, so I didn't have to pay rent anymore. I didn't have to buy groceries.
Okay.
And I think I needed like $50 a week for like going out with my girlfriend money. You know what I mean? Like going out with my friends and doing stuff.
As you say in your book, everybody should have this kind of
happy
money
if
you take care of all the rest.
Absolutely.
And how much were you making? Can you say at the time?
Yeah, I was making $45,000, but imagine that for a 22-year-old.
Yeah, right. You were making negative before.
Yes. right.
So you were able to use most of that.
I did. I paid off my student loan in a year.
1 year.
Yeah.
Rent is such a huge cost, isn't it?
Yeah. It was like, the game changer.
Is it always the biggest thing you see on people's budgets?
House. Where do you live?
House or rent. Yeah. Even if you share with others, especially in this city, in Toronto, or, you know, even in other markets, living at home or having a free place, even for a little bit. My parents were great. They paid rent 6 months once I graduated. That was like my gift.
Yeah.
To give me an opportunity to find a job without having to worry about, I got to take this crappy job that I hate just so I can pay my rent, right?
Yeah.
So that was a nice gift. And you had a similar one where
it's
you...
such a gift,
you
right?
got to live at home, but because you just happened to live... I wanted to be in Toronto because that's where the jobs were.
Yeah, totally.
And you're lucky enough. Like, I took the go this morning. It doesn't take that long, an hour and 12 minutes. And
it's a totally different life commuting in.
It is. I don't know if I would want to do it every day. I'm fine to do it.
It's a grind.
Every so often. Driving is not that any better.
No, that's worse, I think, because at least you can do something with your hands if you're on the go train.
Yeah,
right?
That's right. I was editing a podcast.
There you go.
Actually. Yeah. And listening to other podcasts.
Yeah.
So you're now debt-free and you're working for the boutique firm, but that didn't last.
No. So I moved to the city. My gift to myself was to move out after I set free. So I moved in the city and I was very happy. So I did all my designations within this firm. And at the time, I was convinced that that's where I was going to retire. I was, I had drank the Kool-Aid, like I was in, and that was great. And I remember thinking like, why does everyone have beef with the financial industry? Because that unique firm had good people that it was very like H&N was known for like its transparent fees and good advice and all this stuff. So I remember thinking like it was very high net worth clients, but still thinking, well, this is great. I mean, we're providing a really good service. Yeah. Like, what's the problem?
You found a model that you like.
Yeah.
And start at least a little bit.
Exactly. Anyway. And then we got bought out by a big bank.
Yeah.
So I knew from the get-go that I was never going to be a bank culture person.
Yeah.
So when we got bought out, even though like everything was okay, I'm not hating on the bank, but it just, for my personality, the amount of like red tape and like the, you're now a number in this massive cog and this massive wheel. It just was not a good personality fit for me. And also I learned because you learn about the company that you're in, right? The tiered system, like the different offerings of wealth management that happen when you're not rich.
Yes.
And I never really naively opened my eyes to think about what happens to the people that PH&N like isn't serving, like that don't have $1 million.
They just didn't come to you. They just,
they're happily serviced somewhere else.
Yeah. They're going somewhere else.
What a
right?
naive
you
assumption.
Just happen to get the people with $500,000 or more.
Right. And so that was eye-opening when I learned about all the different ways that someone could approach a bank and where they would be sent depending on how much money they have. And then also understanding like where that advice is going, and then also understanding the sales pitch of the products, because then there's, now you're talking insurance, now you're talking bank products, now you're talking visas. Like, there's a whole bunch of other products that exist, right? That I never really thought about as like baking products into a financial plan. Like that was never what I was doing before.
No.
So at the same time, it was the 2008-2009 crash, and my friends, my peers, were like getting laid off and feeling like they were never going to get ahead and very afraid. And I remember this one time, one of my friends said, she was like, "You're so lucky that you know this stuff, right? Like you feel so much more confident than all of us." And I was like, "I do know this stuff, and I feel more confident than you because I know this stuff." And I was like, "Where can they go?" And there was nowhere for them to go.
You should know this stuff.
And that was kind of this like watershed moment for me, being like, "Okay, you don't have anywhere to go for advice. Oh my gosh, you literally have nowhere to go. Can I be that person?"
Yeah.
And then it started the wheels turning of like, if I am that person, what does that look like and how does that work? And so that's kind of what opened my eyes to like, maybe going down this route is not actually what's for me, because I couldn't stop fantasizing about starting a business to help a different demographic and working with people who are not necessarily millionaires and offering the advice that people can't normally get. Like it became something I thought about all the time.
Well, because you're talking about the democratization of personal finance, which is something I talk about all the time. And you were so ahead of the curve on this. It's like you're like, "Let's all do this." And everybody's like, "You're crazy.
Oh, yeah,
we're making 2.5% on these mutual funds that we're selling. Why would you try to ruin our corporate setup?"
Yes.
And so what are you doing with your money during all this? How are you investing it?
Like me at the time?
Are you drinking their Kool-Aid and 100%. Investing in mutual funds?
Yeah, I was. But the thing was, because we were at a really low fee investment, it was like all good.
You were good in the boutique one.
I was good in the boutique, and then I was like grandfathered into that plan. But that, to me, like, it just, once I learned all the options out there, I was so wanting to get out. And fee-only was something that people just whispered about. It like wasn't even really a thing.
Well, the concept just is strange to me of not fee-only, because the fact that somebody would just only take you as a client if you're going to buy the things that you're selling, and you're only selling a couple of things.
I know.
You know, because it's a difference between, you know, sales, selling products and referring people to places you like, right? Like a robo that you like, or even just referring people to good products, because you have a whole bunch of options, right? You know, what do you think about referral fees? Like, you know, if you get a referral, or I guess assets under management, Is that what you charge?
I don't.
No,
take
you're just a flat fee.
Oh, I am a staunch fee only.
So if somebody charges, and actually I want to have a more detailed conversation about this. If somebody charges 1% of all the money that you invest with them, but the investments are whatever, you know, unbiased, they don't get a commission for selling them. Is that the same?
That's fee based.
Yeah. Okay.
Different.
So fee based versus fee only.
Correct. So fee only works very much like a lawyer's office. So you pay for time only. There's no money management that goes on here. So
yeah.
And I think that it's the ultimate in unbiased advice, because even in a fee-based account, which I completely agree that at that point there's more options. And I think if you're going to do that route, fee-based is a great way to do it.
Yeah.
But let's say that I'm looking at someone's holistic plan. They have a mortgage and they have RRSPs. Well, I still make more money off of them if they put money into their RRSPs versus paying down the mortgage. So I am, even if that's what I think is the right answer, that person goes, well, yeah, of course you want me to invest my money and tell me that the gains there could be 8% versus my mortgage, which is 3%, because that's where your 1% is coming from.
Yeah.
If I make that claim to a client and I say, no, you should put this in your RRSP versus that, there's no doubt in their mind that I genuinely think that, because I don't make more money off of them, whether they put it on their mortgage or invested it. Mm. It's impossible for me to make more money.
Yeah.
And so there's a relief that, okay, this is genuinely... what someone, like, I always tell people, the only way I make more money off of you is if you tell someone to come to me or you come back.
Yeah.
That's all that's in it for me. So I better arm you with a good plan.
But you have to see, okay, I always use my example because I like, you know, I like full transparency and I like everybody to know. So like I will charge a flat fee as you do. Mine's super low, not enough to sustain.
Right.
So I also accepted a referral agreement with a robo-advisor. And so if I tell everybody this and I say, I accepted this agreement because I think this is really, really low fees and it's one of the best options you can get out there. Is that it's bias?
I'm sitting pondering, looking at, I don't, yes, it's biased, but I don't think that makes you shady. Do you know what I mean?
I think being upfront with it.
As long as you're very honest about it.
Right?
Correct. I think if you're very honest about it and you say, hey, this is what I get, but here's why I get it from them, because I think they're wonderful. Here's all the reasons why.
It's because if you end up referring everybody to one place, you might as well try to figure out getting a benefit. It's almost like if people knew that it was after the fact, it's like, this is the place that I would have sent you no matter. But that's for you, you have to charge like a little bit higher.
Yeah.
Because you don't get money any other way.
No other way.
And so how do you deal with people? You probably get some resistance on fees from people.
No, we're still really cheap. So
yeah.
If you look at the broad
compared
spectrum.
Compared to the others, yeah.
Yeah. And so like there's definitely been some like... So if someone comes in for a personal finance session, it's $250.
Yeah.
So where that tends to feel more expensive is for somebody who's like 25.
Yeah.
They have debt and this is a big thing for them to do.
Yeah.
And it's the first time they've ever gotten advice. And so they're not used to the fee only model where you pay for time. They're used to like getting advice for free from a bank.
I know, it's terrible.
So it's that transition period. It's that transition from the advisor to the fee only where it feels like, ooh. And how that doesn't mean that they don't come necessarily, but there's a lot of questions around what you're getting for $250,
and,
right?
And what are they're getting full service?
Full service. Yeah. And so, but someone who's coming in who's younger and they just want some cash flow management, they want that sort of strategy plan, is not as many hours in before, during, and after as somebody who's coming in for a full complex retirement plan, right?
Yeah, okay.
So that's on the more expensive side. So when it comes to the retirement planning and the like portfolio assessments, we get zero pushback there because I almost think that we're too cheap at that level.
For that full plan.
Right. Because you compare to the other firms doing that and we are thousands less, right?
Yeah.
So where we feel that pushback is in that 250 range for the first time person that's coming in for like a personal financial session. Anyone who can't do it, always... actually it breaks my heart. I know exactly when that happens because I have all my team tell me when somebody has written back and said, I can't afford this.
I can't do it. Yeah.
And so we do, like a free pro bono sessions. We have so many that we do each quarter.
Sure.
In addition, I created like a couple of online courses that drop the price to $75 plus HST.
Nice.
So $97 all in. to make it that much more accessible. So it's like, hey, okay, so if you can't come in for the one-on-one, here's another level.
Yeah, okay.
That's an investment still. Like, I understand that the $100 is still a lot, but you get 55%, 60% of everything that I'm going to tell you in person, but you just don't get it as customized for you. You have to kind of like fill in the blanks yourself.
I like that. I like that, to have that option. Yeah, because what I was trying to do was, you know, I want to make it really affordable for people because, like you said, it's really a price. And if I'm given the option to have a huge corporation pay me the money instead of clients, right? Just as long as we deal with the bias and the conflict of interest issues, you know, that, like, you know, I feel a little bit more comfortable with that. And then I can charge basically pennies.
So that's, and I think there's something really to be said for that. And I've questioned from a business owner, actually, a lot about how much money we leave on the table, right? We leave so much money on the table. And sometimes I wonder if I am a purist to the point of like unnecessarily, right? Like if so, because I don't think there's anything wrong with doing exactly what you're doing because you're not referring to someone who's ripping off a client, right?
Well, and I'm also doing less, right? The idea is you pay a small fee and we're going to keep in touch for the lifetime of this, right? But for a lot of people, they don't need a lot of work, right?
Yes.
As you said, it's like, let's just kind of get it all automated, automate that shit, as you like to say, right?
Totally.
In the book or elsewhere. And so I just think if we have more democratization like this, but you're right. It's like, am I charging what I'm worth? Well, we can talk about that, right? I mean, and it could change over time, right? But for now, I just want it to be accessible. And it's probably, I'm guessing you started out more like that, but you couldn't do this working for the big bank.
No.
What did you do?
Yeah, it was not a good fit. To your point, everyone at the time was like, why are you, like, this will never work. There's no business model here. You need sustainable revenue. So the beauty of the financial industry, especially if you sell products like mutual funds or ETFs or insurance, is the sustainable, the premium, like it's over and over and over. It's reoccurring revenue. That's the gorgeousness of the model.
Yeah.
Because you get a client once, you get a sale once, and you win for life.
And then you go, you never see them again, which is the worst.
Right. And so what a wonderful business model. Why would you leave that, right?
It's genius for them.
It's so smart. And like, my life in a lot of ways would be a lot easier if I had stayed out there. So what I did was, because everyone was like, no, I believed them. I thought that I was probably crazy. And so what I did instead was I was like, okay, if I can't actually make a business out of this, because everyone says that someone would already be doing this if it was a thing.
It's the worst thing.
I know. I think back.
It's the worst thing for someone to say to you.
I know.
To say to someone with an idea.
I'm like, oh, poor Shannon. Like, if I could have only told you what I know now.
Yeah.
But I believed it because I really respected a lot of the people that were saying this.
Sure, absolutely,
And so, and you know, logically, that could have made sense. And so, and at the time, I was like 25. And like, if you had asked me to pay $250 for financial advice, I would have been laughed in your face,
sure,
right?
Yeah.
And so I was like, maybe there's something to that. Instead, what I did was I started a project called Barter Babes Project. And so my big plan was to peace out of Bay Street for a year, do this project, get it out of my system, get this idea that I had in my head, like completely out of it, like live my fantasy to work with young people and like help them with their finances in a way that's really accessible and affordable. And then go back into Bay Street and just like toe the company line and just get over it.
So
that was the plan.
Sow your financial oats, if you
will. That's exactly it. And then get married.
That's it. You're married, have baby.
Right.
Keep going with the checklist.
That's it. And so that was my plan. And so the Barter Babes Project was a 1-year project where my goal was to, again, with the goals, right?
Yeah.
I'm very much a Capricorn. and so the goal was to hit like 300 women. I wanted to work specifically with women because I also found, in not only at the high level of net worth, but even amongst friends, women lack their confidence. So everybody has the same literacy, but the women were second guessing way more often, right?
Which is top of the news today, much more so than it ever has been,
totally.
Which is fine. But you were recognizing this way early. This is
2010.
Yeah. And it's like 8 years later. And I mean, the Canadian Personal Finance Conference, which we were both at.
Yes.
And you spoke at?
Yes, I did.
Yes.
Yes, I did.
I forget if you were just there or you you spoke. And it was all women.
Yeah.
Except for that one guy pitching, and I gave him an earful. And it was great, right? Yeah. And that was intentional, but wouldn't it be great to have that be unintentional, right?
Yeah.
Right?
That would be
as
great.
Opposed to the unintentional all white male panels that are out there these days. But yeah, you were prime, and this was Barter Babes specifically.
It was specifically for women, and I didn't charge anything,
except for stuff.
So experiences, services, and things that I needed, right? So I had a list I would post every week, like, here are the things that I need this week or in the next month. If you've got one of these things, like, reach out to me. The beauty of that project was that I met with 300 women. I provided financial advice, fee-only financial advice for no fee, and from everything from like lasagnas to I actually got two bikes out of it. So my partner and I both got a bike. He still rode his for a long time.
These things cost money. It's not like you weren't getting value.
No.
Money is just a store of value.
Absolutely. And
so you got it.
I got it. The problem was, like, I did save up enough for my rent for the year, but the problem was that I couldn't barter fast enough for things that I needed in daily life. So, like,
yeah.
I ended up still having to spend money that I didn't have. And so just to, like, get through until the next little bit, because let's say I wanted to get my hair colored, okay? Because I've been gray since I was 21 years old. And so I would want to do that, like, in the next 4 weeks, but maybe somebody didn't want to barter for that for another 3 or 4 months. And so I've realized that that is something that I will absolutely go into debt for. Like, I will go into debt to cover my gray hair. And so
this is on your fixed income.
100%.
Fixed expenses. Sorry.
I took on so much debt the year that I did Barter Babes. So much debt in such a short period of time.
But with the altruistic motive.
But I had no money coming in.
No money coming in. Like, I hear you.
That's it. So I saved up enough for rent, but, like, that was really it. And, like, I did live with my now husband, but, like, boyfriend at the time, who thought I was bizarre, but he wasn't making so much money either. We were basically just hand to mouth, and life costs money. And I think bartering serves an absolute, it should be in everyone's budget to, like, try to replace things with barter. But as your entire way of making money, it just wasn't efficient enough at that time.
Well, you're basically providing a modern example of why money was invented.
100%.
Right?
And that's exactly it. And, like, buns wasn't a thing then. So,
buns,
like, yeah.
But you're right. A buns alone financial plan is not good. But yeah, like, you know, I took the history of money, 1200 to 1550, in university as part of my program. And it's the course I remember the most. The spice trade, the spice wars, all this stuff. But money is because bartering for, just like what you said, timing, seasonality.
Yeah.
In my interview with the guys from Uganda, that's one of the issues with trading goods. Is that the seasonality aspect, right? You might have a good season, and then you have all this bucket of money, and you have to spend it right away because you're worried about being robbed or you're losing it somehow, right? So there's no bank for you to put it in, that kind of stuff. So you learn that, and so at the end of this year,
It's the best and worst year of my life.
Yeah.
It was the best year because I was, like, living out this fantasy that I had been, like, obsessed with for years now at this point. And I felt like for the first time I was, like, having a real impact on people's lives. Like, I knew I was always helping. I always felt that way, but this was the first time that I felt like I was impacting lives in a way that made me feel so proud. And yes, it literally felt so satisfying, even though I wasn't making any money.
It's a thing that if somebody said, if money wasn't an object, what would you do?
I would still do this.
And that's it.
Yes.
That's what we should all try to do.
Yes, I would still do it because I wasn't making money and I was still obsessed with it. And so I was, like, completely hooked. And I caught the entrepreneurial bug at that point too, which I think was always destined to be. And then so at the end of it, I remember Matt, like my husband now, again, boyfriend at the time, being like, so, what's the plan? Like, are you going back to Bay Street or are you going to make a go at this? And I was like, I really want to make a go at this. And he's like, well, we've already been living on nothing. So anything at this point is an improvement. Like, if you make $20 this week, it's better than a lasagna, right? Like,
right.
That's good. So I launched New School in 2012 And right. Here we are 6 years later.
And so the new School of Finance, it started with just you.
Just me in my living room.
For how long?
Oh, we got these offices that you're sitting in right now. This was my first office. Like, now we have all these spaces too.
Yeah.
But this, I got this February 2013. So I was in my office at home at my kitchen table for all of 2012 and then just into 2013. Then I got this. And then we've slowly been expanding. And I hired my first person who still works with us.
Mm.
I hired Colleen. When did I hire Colleen? 2014. So it was just me from 2012 to 2014.
Okay.
And so now there's six of us.
And so you hired people because you had too many clients?
Yeah. I couldn't keep up.
You couldn't keep up.
Yeah.
And you had built the courses though.
No, those came in 2015.
Okay. So those came later. So mm-hmm. for people, and was it mainly due to affordability or you just wanted people who maybe couldn't get in with you? Or people who weren't here in the city.
The courses?
Yeah.
All of those reasons. All of the above. So yeah. I had enough feedback from clients that was like, hey, you're not nearby and I would like to do this. I'm more of a DIY kind of person. Do you have any options for us?
Sure.
It was also like, it's there's only one of me. And at the time it was something that it was easily like, hey, here's my brain and you I could scale with it. So it was a business decision. And then it also added one more layer of accessibility of information that from a trusted resource on the, like that someone could get if they wanted like access to my brain. Mm-hmm. So all of those reasons, and that happened in 2015.
And so at a certain point you became the media person, the person the media would go to,
yeah.
to talk about, was it just millennial personal finance or just for personal finance in a fun sort of,
I think so.
You know, non-censored kind of way.
Yeah. I, a lot of people ask me how that started and I can't actually recall. It was a snowball. It wasn't. So right now it looks very impressive, right? My media presence is very impressive.
Exactly.
But you know, 2012 Shannon was like, not, that wasn't like a thing. It started slowly. One time when I had done Barter Base, because it was such an outrageous project. I was interviewed on City TV. And they came and they're like, what? Sorry, you're not accepting cash for a year? Like, what's the deal? And then that led to a second interview about Barter Babes. But what happened was because of those two interviews, two producers now knew that I was a financial planner who was certified, who could speak to money in a fun way that was not stuffy.
That's it. It's a rare thing, isn't it? Because either somebody might be certified,
right?
Because they typically want someone, especially for media.
For media, right? Yeah.
But they're just somebody in a suit. And then the fun people are the ones who, you know, wrote a blog
right.
and, you know, got attention that way and then maybe figure stuff out later. But mostly, so you're like a combination of both.
Well, I guess, right? And so then once you have somebody who knows that you're able to do that in a pinch, they might call you. So that's kind of how it started. It really started organically and slowly.
Mm.
It's never been why New School had a lineup. I promise you that. I have been in the media now so many times and it's not like you know, you go on a TV show and you do a segment and then like the phone rings off the hook. It's not
Yeah,
like
I remember
that.
You saying that. You were just waiting and nothing happened. But then you said also the things you never thought would create traffic did.
Yes. And so there's that. And then also what I think the media does to help and why I'm so grateful for it is that it validates, especially as a young woman in finance. If I was on the news, then somebody who might think that I don't know what I'm talking about is like, well, she must know what she's talking about.
That's
because
right.
she was on the dang news,
exactly.
right? And so for me, I have been so grateful for that exposure for sure, but more so the validation and the credibility that it's given me. So that's because I'm doing something super weird, not so much now, but back 5 years ago, I actually remember one guy said to me, he called Colleen and he was like, why are you so cheap? What's wrong with you?
Sure. Yeah.
And she was like, excuse me? And he was like, well, I don't trust you because like, if you were good, you'd be charging more. So why are you so cheap? So again, that kind of like question mark around what I'm doing. And for people, especially who don't know, who didn't hear about me from a friend, I think the media really helped to hone in my cred and give me street cred while I was young and starting out. So I owe a lot to it, even though it's not the, like, you do a segment, the phone rings off the hook. That's not why I think media is important for people. I think it's important because it adds to credibility.
You have how many people here now?
Six, full-time.
Six, full-time. Yeah. And everybody, are they, so you have your CIM, are you a CFP too?
Yeah.
And does everyone have CFP? Or are they working on
advice giving. So there's not six financial planners.
No, just six people.
So
here.
We have one person who does taxes. She's CPA.
CPA.
And then we have another financial planner, and she's in her, she's getting her experience for her CFP. So she's like, not there yet.
Yeah, but get in there. Yeah, it's so you have a little people here, and then did you take some time off to have the baby?
I did.
Yeah.
It's the scariest
thing. And it left everybody here?
I left everyone here.
That's so hard for a small business.
Yes, it is. And it was a wonderful, incredible, I owe everything to this team. So I was very scared doing that. It was very scary because I had always been this like driving force, right? So like, if we're looking at the pipeline and we weren't booked out 2 months in advance or something, I'd be like, okay, like, let's wrestle, okay. Like, shake some
filling
trees, do
calendar.
Some talks, do some
okay.
stuff, right?
Yeah.
And so I was always doing that, and I was scared that if I, like, you know, didn't do that, that all somehow business would dry up and we would all lose our jobs. I didn't actually believe that. Like, I took the time, but that was the 3 a.m. fear, right?
Sure.
But, like, I have an amazing support team. I have an amazing planner. Like, Liz is our other financial planner, and she's fantastic. And so I took 4.5 months off, and new school was totally fine.
Like radio silence, or like, were you just kind of in
radio,
the background?
I saw no client for 4.5 months.
No client, so.
And radio silent, yes, except I 100% would be like once a week or something, I would probably check in or have a call and just be like, are you guys good? Because as a small business owner, there's still a lot of hats that I wear that are not delegated, that at the end of the day, the buck still stops here and someone's got to do it.
Yeah.
So I say that I think I probably worked about 6 hours a week, even on the first week of my baby's life. So like, but it was like all through email, and it wasn't like I was working. I was just like, yep, that's okay. Or like, no, that's a thing. Or like, oh shoot, I have to send that to this person because it's still my job that hasn't been delegated out. But I saw no client for 4.5 months, which is, I used to be afraid to take 4 days off work.
Well, yeah. And if you're by yourself, I mean, it's almost like being a single parent almost, right?
Yeah.
Because if you're running the business and it's you only, then hopefully you have a spouse, which, you know, many people do, but many people don't.
Yeah.
And if that spouse can also take time off, you know, it's kind of a 50-50, but still even 50% of your time, then again, the mother of the baby right after the baby is born, that's, you want to spend the time, right? Like there's so many things for you to consider as a small business owner. And did you get a book offer during this time?
When I was pregnant.
Okay.
Yeah. And so So there's two things that you just nailed.
Yeah.
100%. I think that what made me able to do that for anybody else out there who's a business owner is that I have another person that works with me who can do my job while I'm gone.
It's important, isn't it?
Yes. So the other team members are not the person that replaces my job. They're support for me and everybody, and they keep this place running. Mm. Better than I ever could. They're amazing. Like, I think we would crumble up and die if they left me. But to actually replace the revenue that comes in. Because if you step out of the business and you're the only person that can actually create revenue for the business, then nobody has a job.
You're done. Yeah.
So you really have to find a replacement so that the business can keep running.
A lot of people are scared to do this, aren't they?
Totally. And I was terrified. I'm terrified every time I hire someone. I'm literally terrified. Yeah. I lose a night's sleep every time because there's so many complex emotions attached with hiring someone. Like, A, people are expensive, but I believe in paying people a fair wage. B, what if they don't work out? Oh my gosh. C, I'm insecure. What if they think I'm this and I don't deliver?
Yeah.
Right? So especially with the media and stuff, people think that there's a preconceived notion of like what they might be coming into, but like, you're in my office, there's nothing pretentious about this, right? But like, you know, new school, what is it? And then it's like, what if I'd let them down? What if I am not good enough for them?
I thought you'd have pictures of yourself all over from all the articles.
Yeah, they just drop down from the screen.
Here's the collage.
So, yeah. Oh, you didn't see our trophy room?
I'll take it out.
But like, I guess my own insecurity as a human being is just like, well, I hope they think I'm good enough that I live up to like, why they're excited to work here. I hope that I live up to that, right? Like, I hope I create a work environment that makes them want to stay.
This is imposter syndrome.
100%.
And people, especially if you have any kind of success, I think everybody experiences this.
Right? I think everyone does, whether they're honest about it or not.
We're taught to be ashamed of our failures and not proud of our successes.
Is that somewhere in the middle? Yeah.
I don't understand. Like, let's, you know, it's humility is valued somehow more so than being proud of ourselves.
I know.
And we need to focus more on that, right?
I think so, to a degree. Maybe I'm only saying to a degree because it's been beaten out of me. I don't know. But, like, I say that jokingly. But, like, I don't know. I think maybe there's some tie to, like, people who are overly proud are maybe a type of person typically. I don't know.
Maybe they rub it in our faces and
I don't know.
So we don't like
but
them.
What's wrong with that? Like, I don't know. I don't know. It's a complex thing, but that for sure. I think as a business owner, imposter syndrome is normal and a little healthy, because I think you should always be questioning whether or not you are doing your best job and how you could, like, maybe not imposter syndrome, but I think it's always good to just question where things are at and ask if they can be better and if that's something that you can do. Mm. Right. And I think that, so, you know, if somebody comes in and they're really stoked to work in New School, like, I want to create a space where they feel stoked about New School beyond the first 3 months. Like,
yeah.
You know, and like,
it's a lifetime thing. Right?
Absolutely. And so, like, it drives me to make sure that I can do that for them, or try anyways to do that. Right. But we got off track there, which is great. But, like, yeah, so taking 4 months off was tough. And now I'm back part-time.
Okay, so you are part-time now.
I am part-time right now.
And are there people who are like, I need Shannon and only Shannon, and only Shannon will do?
So, yes, not most people, but I'm booked out till July. So that's, like, 3 months from now, which is actually not a great problem to have. Everyone's like, what a good problem to have. I'm like, this is a terrible problem to have. but, like, I would say that the people who will only see me, it's few and far between. And when it does happen, I understand it, because it's typically someone who's been working with me since 2012.
Yeah. From the
beginning. And I wouldn't want to go to somebody else either. And, no. And they have been with me from the get-go.
Yeah.
And there is a loyalty that I just, like, you have literally allowed me to, like, buy groceries for the first time when I thought that I was going to throw my business. I almost quit the business, like, 3 times.
It might be some of the people in your book.
There's definitely a couple of them. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Are all the names changed, or did you ask them?
Yeah. Yes.
Sorry.
Yes.
I just wonder if you get permission from them, or if they just, I forget if you use last names, probably not.
No. So I asked permission. So a lot of times I recorded sessions and I asked permission, and then I changed names, and I even changed the city that people were living in sometimes.
So just to throw it the other way.
Yeah.
So the book is called, I'm looking at a bunch of copies right now. It's called Worry Free Money.
Yes, it is.
And we were talking about book names when we were with Melissa at the event.
It's stressful.
Because she's trying to figure out a name.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's a stressful thing. It's like I reference picking a band name, or I guess, you know, picking a child's name.
Totally.
It's like, because it is kind of like a second baby.
Oh, absolutely. Right? Oh, yeah, and the pregnancy thing. So, like, the book, the manuscript, and my baby were due on the same day.
No. Are you...
Yeah. So I was like, so how, 42 weeks pregnant, and I handed in the copy.
So you got the offers. People came to you.
So yes.
Or you wanted to write one.
I wanted to write one. Yeah. I had an agent, and then she was able to shop it. Okay. So, like, I wasn't, like, knocking on, like, publishers' doors being like, hope you like this. Like, no. And then so they came back. They were like, we want this book. I was 19 weeks pregnant. I didn't know whether or not I should say yes to it. I called my mom, who's my mentor as well, and I'm obsessed with her. And she was like, you don't say no to a book deal. And I was like, okay. So then I signed the book deal, met with my editor in January. This is 2017.
Mm.
She was like, I'm like, P.S., I'm pregnant. She had just had a baby. So she was like, damn.
She could feel it.
Yeah. And she was like, well, we're just going to do this. And she was amazing. So she helped me do this. And so basically the reason that the book was due the same day as the baby is because I basically had to finish it before he came.
Yeah.
And so that's why. And so I
handed
it in.
I can just see her writing with a newborn in your arms.
Oh yeah, no, that's
like,
not a thing.
It's not happening.
And my editor knew that because she had just had a baby. So she was like, you need to get this thing into
us before he
comes. And so that was fabulous. So she worked tirelessly with me. She was so patient and wonderful. And we managed to get it done. And I say we because it's 100% a team effort, because I would write things and then like send them. And then we had this whole rotating thing.
That's so great. It's great to have that kind of an ally with you on this. It's such a hard thing, right? I've talked to various people who've written books, and it's
an intimate relationship.
It's intimate.
Yeah.
Did you know what you wanted to write before you wrote it though?
Yep. I think what's scariest about the concept of writing a second book is that this book was percolating in my brain for years.
Okay, yeah.
And I had already had little blurby posts or that like never intended to be published, but like which some of them actually ended up being published now in this book, but like stories about like compelling things that have happened or lessons or ways that I, like the Beyoncé factor, for example. Like I remember just shooting like just chatting with somebody in my office, and I was like, it's like Beyoncé. We can call this the Beyoncé factor. And like, I said it. And then it kind of became something that I said in meetings. And then it became something that like I wrote down. And that all happened before I even had a book or a deal or anything like that. It was just like in a document on my, in Word.
And I just mentioned the Beyoncé factor to someone this morning. And it just, these are the kind of things that we need. It's so relatable. Right? It just kind of makes you be like, yeah, why am I weird about my neighbor or coworker when I don't know anything about them?
Right.
They could very well be Beyoncé for all I know.
Yeah.
And no one's going to sit down and give you the financial statements. And if they do tell you something, who knows if it's accurate?
It's probably
who knows
big.
What they're leaving out?
Yes.
Right? There's all that. So you have great stuff like this in the book, Worry-Free Money, and you picked it because you don't want people to worry about money.
Yeah. I think I was telling you this about last week. At the end, my editor asked me an amazing question. She was like, at the end of the book, when they shut the book, how do you want that person to feel, right? Mm-hmm. Like, what's their journey been from beginning to end? And like, the answer was always like, I want them to worry less. That's like that's the punch. I also wanted them to feel less guilty and less afraid, which is in the subtitle, but like, I want less worry. And so that's where that's like the ongoing theme of the book. The original working title was something like Get Real About Your Money or something like that,
which
felt resonant and true at the time. But like, that's not what, when they close the book, the worry is the thing that you can put your finger on and say, now you're less worried.
So there's tons of great things in the book. We could actually have a whole other podcast about
Hendo.
This book. Including things like, you know, the happy spending versus unhappy spending.
My favorite.
The categories, all the stuff, that budgets are not the answer,
No. You
know, et cetera. But I think we're good for today. You should go get Worry Free Money. So if someone wants to get Worry Free Money, where do they go? Everywhere?
Yeah. So it's like, it's online. It's for sale on Amazon or Indigo or in bookstores.
Do we even have to tell people where to get books anymore?
You know what?
Just Google where to buy
Google
a book.
Google where to buy a book, for sure. But I think that there's something to be said for... if you go and buy a book, but you know what is funny? It's hard to find bookstores these days. Like, they're not as many as there used to be. Like, again, analog childhood.
Yeah. But there's digital versions, right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
It's audiobook coming, maybe?
No idea.
No, but not. It's one of those things that it actually, you wrote a book and then somebody's like, somebody's got to read this. Or you, and you would apparently, from what I've heard, have to audition to read your own book.
Which I would 100% do. Yeah, I would love to read the book because it's like, I would love to read it. Not,
of course.
It would be so fun.
You know, Kate Flanders did this for her book, The Year of Less, and I love audiobooks because it's hard for me to read, having ADD, even though medicated. It's just something nice about her reading it to me, right?
It's like, tell me a bedtime story.
Because it's from her perspective anyway, right? And you're telling these stories that are in the book. It's you, and it makes so much sense. I don't know, like, unless you're somehow defunct at reading or just, like, don't want to.
Yeah.
Everybody should read their own book.
Or have a really high-pitched, weird voice. I don't know.
Even if it takes a while. Like, take a long time. Do it over a day, like, a year, and read a sentence a day, and then they can cut it all together. I don't know. I think that's probably better. But, so just go. So, ShannonLeeSimmons.com.
Yep.
NewSchoolOfFinance.com.
Yeah. All roads lead to Rome. So, like.
Google Shannon Lee Simmons. Not without the Lee, because the other Shannon Simmons will come up, right?
Oh, Shannon Lee Tweed?
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah. She is she a Lee, too?
L-E-E. Yeah, people confuse me for her on Twitter.
So, yeah, Shannon Tweed, yeah, exactly. Mary Jean Simmons.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, yeah, that's, so that's, it's, this is not the same person who married Jean Simmons.
I did not marry Jean Simmons. My husband's name is Matt.
I'm really glad that we cleared that up.
Yeah, just in case.
Yeah, so, yeah, Jean Simmons from Kiss, if anybody doesn't know.
Yeah.
Okay, so do we have time to do this next, this final segment?
What time is it?
It's 1:30.
Yeah, we're good.
Okay, we're good. We do all this stuff in the afternoon. This is how we do entrepreneurs.
I like it. Right? I also like how we just threw down randomly. And this is wonderful.
You know, and it's really windy outside. Otherwise, we would have been outside today.
It is very gusty.
Wind is like, you know, what was it, 80 kilometer winds
today? Yeah, it's like stay inside.
Wind is the worst thing for podcasts because all you hear is wind. It doesn't matter. It could be raining or snowing. That's fine. Wind, no. Wind. So... you know, we'll cut this part out if it doesn't work out, but I wanted to try this because, so Shannon sings and plays piano, and so do I. So we have, it's a little name that tune sort of thing, so.
I'm not a musician, though. I sing and play piano, but I'm not a musician.
So I have these cards, and we're going to sing the first line. So you sing the first line of the song, and you try to guess what the song is.
Okay.
Or sing the next line of the song.
Okay, I'll try.
You can pick the song that actually... it's actually works. So I'm gonna pick it. Start with an old song, okay?
Okay, let's hope I get it.
Okay, just listen to the music of the traffic in the city.
Downtown. Oh my god.
Right?
Happy. How can you lose the light so much brighter?
Right. I don't know that line very well either. But yeah, Downtown by
Downtown.
Do you remember who?
No idea.
Petula Clark.
There it is.
It's linger on the sidewalk where the neon signs are pretty. Okay.
How can you lose?
How can you lose? Yeah.
Okay.
So you go and I'll try to guess.
That's great.
So some of the songs in the cards are either really old or new or are hard to sing.
Okay. This is a great one.
Okay.
I made it through the wilderness.
Okay. I don't know the second line because it's just a blur of words to me, but Like a Virgin, Madonna.
You got it. Somehow I made it through.
Oh, that's so obvious, right?
That's a great one.
I should have figured it'd be simpler.
Yeah, no,
right?
That's perfect. Well done, though. Well done.
Okay. Like a Virgin. I don't know if you'll get it. You might get this one. There comes a time when we heed a certain call.
Oh! When the world dun 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 dun,
that's pretty
we
good.
Are the world.
That's it. When the world must come together as one.
We are the world.
We are the world. I think who was singing that was Lionel Richie, I believe.
Oh, I have no
but
idea.
But the artist was USA for Africa. That's what it is. And yeah, we had a Canadian one. Northern Lights. Tears Are Not Enough.
It is. We
did. Yeah. Remember that one?
Absolutely, man.
Okay, sorry. I gotta stop looking ahead here. Don't pick this card.
Okay. But, all right, hold on. Okay, we'll go for it.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I don't care if Monday's blue.
Tuesday something, Wednesday too.
Yeah!
What is it? Tuesday?
Tuesday's gray and Wednesday too.
Tuesday's gray and Wednesday too. Monday, I'm in love by The Cure.
Friday, but yes.
Friday, I'm in love. Oh, yeah. Of course. I was stuck on the first line. Okay, Friday, I'm in love by The Cure.
Should do one more.
Okay, a couple more? One more?
Okay, yeah, a couple okay. more. I get nervous.
Okay, this is a good one. Father, 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 help us.
Oh my gosh, I'm blanking, and I know this song. And as soon as you tell me, I'm going to be so mad at myself.
That's the thing about this game. It's just really hard from hearing the first line.
Right?
Do you know the song?
I can't.
I'm blanking on the song title, too.
What is it?
Where's the Love?
By who?
Black Eyed Peas.
Oh my God!
Right?
Yes! Oh yes!
So,
oh.
Father, help us!
Like I don't even know the next word.
Send some guidance from above.
I would never have got that. I know
okay,
that song.
I'll do one more to give you a chance.
Okay. I hope I get it. Where is the love? Oh, yes. Okay, now it's there. Yes, I couldn't even think about it even after you told me what it was. I'm like, wait, what song is that?
These are tough.
Some
right?
of them are really tough.
We don't need no education.
Hey, teacher, that's not the next word. Leave them kids alone. Is it Supertramp?
No, it's Pink Floyd.
Pink Floyd, darn!
Pink Floyd.
Okay, we don't need no education. I don't know. Is it We Don't Need to Educate? No, what is it? What's it called?
It's The Wall. Another Brick in the Wall. Yeah.
Okay, but I know the song.
The thing about this is it's the first line of every song, right?
Yeah.
So it's often the second line of a song
is the one that hooks
something
us.
We not even know.
And it's not
it
the
might
chorus.
Just be a blur. It's not the chorus. It's not the tag.
Yeah.
It's not the hook.
Right.
And so to know that is tough. Okay. Good.
But I feel like I at least get a half point for that because I knew it.
Oh no!
I knew,
yeah. You got
but
it.
I was thinking of Supertramp because I was thinking like I'm like the school theme. No, but it wasn't though.
I do. I'm a big Supertramp fan.
Can I do one more for you?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Do you think I looked at that card, so don't do that one.
Okay.
Even though there's some good stuff on there.
I love the altruism. Okay. And again, what I think you might know versus what I know.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? We don't know each other's musical.
This should be
okay.
This should be
see?
Relatively. Okay. I hope I don't set you up for failure, but I feel like you'll be able to get this. Okay. A little bit of Monica in my life.
A little bit of Mary? No.
No, but it's fine.
A little bit
there.
Of something by my side?
Yes.
Okay. I don't know the name because he mentions like four different, five
Erica.
Different. Yeah, a little bit. Erica by my side. Mama number five by Lou Vega.
There you go.
Perfect.
Nailed it.
Okay. That's a good one to end.
That's a great one.
The one hit wonder of the time. Okay. Shannon, it was great. Thanks for having me here at the New School of Finance.
Thanks for coming and thanks for having me on
the
show.
Yeah, I really, you know, in a way, I wish we could talk about your book more, but I wanted to talk about you.
That's
and your personal finance story. And people can buy the book.
Oh,
that's
they can
the
absolutely.
Idea.
Yeah, you can buy the book.
Buy the book to learn more.
Yes.
And yeah, Shannon's got you guys tons of YouTube videos, I'm sure. Just and if you have a chance to see. Don't you have a cool event coming up, or did it already happen?
I have a library talk tonight, and then I have this week it's the keynote for this big boss press that I'm doing.
That's right. Yeah. So this is like Girl Boss?
Yes.
Absolutely. So you're promoting the book, you're doing events, keynotes, all this kind of stuff, because people just like to hear you talk about money, and it's really good stuff. Right?
I guess so.
That's why you're booked until July, even though you don't want to be.
That's because I'm part-time because I have a baby.
That's right, exactly. Okay, awesome, and hopefully I'll have you on the show again.
I would love that. This was fun.
Real fun. Thanks, Shannon.
Thank you.
If you like this episode, please subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. It would mean a lot to me, and it only takes a few seconds. For the show notes and any links from the episode, head over to my website, investwisely.ca. And while you're there, please feel free to send me a message on my contact page. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of The Personal Finance Show. I'll be back next week with John Kalos, financial planner and host of the podcast, Confessions of an Ex-Banker.